History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories around you that really should not go untold. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Fresno, California with 101-year-old Jack Wolf. He has quite a story. He has quite a legacy. Just sitting in his office, I see the pictures of all 24 of his grandkids who never would have been born if he didn't survive World War II, let alone his impact on the agricultural industry in California and in the world. But let's go way back, Jack. You grew up in Arizona. You had a twin brother. Eventually, you'd have a couple other siblings. Tell me what those earliest memories of being a kid in Arizona were like for you.
Well, we grew up on a farm, and the Great Depression, of course, came along, and my father decided that he needed a monthly check, so he went the dairy route, and he started out with about 10 cows, and we grew to have a herd of about 50 cows that we milked every day. That meant morning and evening. And I had a twin brother, and so between the three, my father and my brother and myself, we milked those cows every morning and every evening. That I remember vividly. My father always told us that the mechanical milker wasn't good for the cows. But when my brother and I left to go to business school in Los Angeles, he got a mechanical milker. No, times were difficult, as we call them. But everyone else was in the same position. So we weren't selected or by ourselves. Wages of that day is hard for folks today to think. You recall that my father would hire a man to work on the farm, and he paid $1 a day, and that was a 12-hour day, which meant he was getting just a little over 8 cents an hour. When I first started working at Anderson Clayton, I was paid $60 a month. After a year or so, I finally got up to $100, and I thought that was about as good as it could get at that time.
Well, and I've got to ask you, you made that comment about your father and the mechanical milker. Are you saying that now you think that was just his excuse, that he had to tell you it was bad for the cows so you and your brother would keep milking them?
Probably. That was probably it.
And I know that you can't have the kind of career you've had without hard work, without discipline. But have you ever worked harder than on that dairy, milking those cows morning and evening and probably going to school in between?
Well, I wouldn't say that. It's different type work. After college and World War II, I ended up and went to work for Mr. Russell Giffen. Over the time, I became a business manager and spent a lot of hours.
I know this is a long time ago, if you're 101 years old, and I say, tell me about when you're 8 or 9 or 10, but do you remember as a boy having some ideas? Hey, when I grow up, here's the kind of life I'm going to have, or here's the kind of job I'm going to have. Did you have those dreams or ambitions?
Not when I was 8 or 9 that I can recall. As a teenager, I thought that if I could have a chance, I would chase it pretty hard.
And you mentioned going to business school, and you and your twin brother went together. Were you two pretty close? Did you have that twin connection people talk about?
Yes, we were close. As we got to be young men, we began to poke one another in the eye in a way. I recall one time having lunch with him in Phoenix, and a banker came along that we both knew, and he told the banker that I was okay, but I was slow pay. So anyway, we had that sort of a relationship. We visited about once every 10 days the rest of our lives.
So you go to business school together, and then you get done with that, and you go to work, and the war still hasn't come yet. In those late 30s, was there any hint, because of what was going on in other parts of the world, that you had any concern you might end up in the service?
Yes, we left together with three other guys about our age, so there were five of us in one place. We were conversation about what might be happening.
And then you heard about this peacetime draft?
Yes, we definitely. Well, we had to go down and register. That put the emphasis that you knew you were going to go in for 1 year.
1 year. Yeah, that's not exactly what happened, I know. But how did you feel about that at the time? Because I'm sure you're trying to progress in your job and you have these ideas and, you know, here's this life in front of you and Uncle Sam says, hey, we need you in uniform.
Well, that was just part of the time, then we accepted that we had to do that. I don't recall of dwelling on it particularly. I thought at that time that we'd go in and have 1 year because even the government was saying that we would not be getting involved in the European thing. But then Pearl Harbor came along and we all knew that we were going to be stuck in there for a while.
Well, and I want to ask you about that day, because everyone seems to remember something about December 7th. But with regard to your brother, was he drafted as well?
He got drafted about 30 days after I got caught. We were living in Los Angeles, so we were inducted at San Pedro. And when you were in San Pedro, they asked you which service that you thought you'd like to train on. And he said infantry, and I said Coast Artillery. I thought Coast Artillery sounded a little safer.
Well, we'll hear about that a little later. And the only reason I ask is I've talked to a lot of veterans who had siblings or best buddies that they went in together with, and they thought, hey, we'll be able to stay together throughout the service. It sounds like you and your brother never even thought of that.
No, we did not think about joining together.
And what kind of outfit did he end up with?
He ended up in the 79th Regiment Infantry. He went overseas about 6 months after D-Day.
And you are a little closer to D-Day than that, but let's talk about December 7th, 1941. Where were you and how'd you find out what had happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was at Camp Callan near La Jolla, near San Diego. There was a handful of three or four of us had gone to Tijuana to do what you do in Tijuana. We had a radio on, and we heard about Pearl Harbor and the instructions to get back to your base.
How did things change after that? Did you notice a difference in your Army experience after Pearl Harbor?
Well, yes. In my case, before Pearl Harbor, an acquaintance of mine came by to visit, and she had her current gentleman friend was a retired Navy officer. He told me that I should sign up for officer school, and I thought, he doesn't know that I'm getting out in just a few months, and I didn't do anything about it. Wherever they had gone, they came back, and they stopped again after 2 or 3 weeks, and that time he made a push again that I consider officer school, and he made the point that in his judgment there would be a war, and he presented the premise that I had about 4 months left, and if I got accepted soon, in 90 days I'd be an officer, and so it overlapped. I really wasn't going to get caught. If there was a war, I would be in better shape. If there wasn't, it wasn't bad to have under. So anyway, that's what happened.
Have you ever wondered how your war experience would have been different had you not taken his advice?
Well, I don't think I ever dwelled on that. I did think that it was a plus, personally, to be an officer.
Well, and back in those days, what was officer candidate school like? How did they treat you? What did they make you do?
The first step, you had to take an exam to show how much smarts, I guess. Anyway, I aced that dude. I wasn't all that bright, but whatever number they asked me, it just so happened I did quite well. And so I was told that I had been accepted and I would be notified of where the school would be. I didn't know that they were just setting it up, and they set it up at Wilmington, North Carolina. And I didn't hear anything. I kept going by about once a week. to headquarters at Camp Kellen to inquire, did they have any word? And one day Pearl Harbor happened, and within the week I had a notice to move in 2 weeks.
So I guess I should put this in context, too. Over the years that followed, as you become an officer and then you're called to lead all these other young men, you were probably one of the old men, weren't you, even though you're only 24, 25 years old?
I don't know that I ever thought of it that way, but anyway, there were some, quite a few younger ones than myself.
You had requested Coast Artillery, and they end up putting you in charge of a gun battery, Battery A of the 204th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery. Can you explain what that meant, what your duties consisted of, how much you were responsible for?
Well, let me digress just a moment. I was assigned to a battalion, and they were heading for Panama for jungle training, and they gave us yellow fever shot, and about half of the folks, including myself, had an adverse effect. We all came down with jaundice. I went to the dispensary, and they said, here's another one. And so I was laid up for about 30 days to get rid of that jaundice. Meanwhile, my unit went to Panama, and they ended up in the South Pacific. So I had missed them. And I spent about the next 4 months as part of a train crew. We would pick up folks from Kilmer and take them all the way on a troop train all the way to the West Coast, San Francisco. And I made 3 or 4 cross trips. And when I learned that there was a new gun and aircraft, I signed up for that. After about 60 days training on that, I was sent to Camp Edwards on Cape Cod.
Well, I guess maybe I should ask, too, because time is passing, and you just mentioned, you know, you would have been heading to the South Pacific. Who knows how different your life would have been in that case, if you even made it back from the war. But you're going cross-country on these trains, and it just hits me, how different was the atmosphere of America back then? Can you describe for us the sentiment or the feeling or the unity that existed in the country then?
Well, if you needed a ride and you were in uniform, all you had to do was get out on the curb and put your thumb up, and there'd be about 3 cars stopped to pick you up. There was no question that the feeling was very strong by everyone.
So Cape Cod, more training, and are you itching to get overseas? Do you want a piece of this fight, or are you content to be exactly where you are?
No, I don't recall having any thoughts that I wanted to get there. I just knew that we would probably end up and be there. You accepted that was happening. But from Cape Cod, we had training on Long Island, maneuvers they called them, and then maneuvers on that going out toward Provincetown on Cape Cod. And we traipsed around that part of the country, and we ended up at Fort Devens near Boston, and that's where we were outfitted to go overseas, and we left in early January of 1944.
And how much were you responsible for at that point? Who were you in charge of, or what were the duties that you had to maintain and keep an eye on?
I don't know whether it's boring to you. When we had the first 40-millimeter gun, they had a manual telling you how to get it in place of firing. And the commanding colonel, chicken colonel, full colonel, told us that we were never to deviate. And I raised my hand and told him that I thought we had found a way to do it better. We had a demonstration of what we were doing, and he said, write that up for her and send it to my headquarters. And shortly, the Campbell Amendment came down the pike. From that, our battalion commander tagged me to be S3, in charge of operations and so forth for the battalion. I did that at Cape Cod, and it was about when we were at Long Island that they decreed that the S3 should be a major. But we had 2 or 3 guys that had been in the National Guard and had something like 20 years' experience. And they, of course, seniority-wise, preceded me. They told me that I should cease being S3 and I would change places with Bob Denig, who had charge of Battery A. And so I switched and became battery commander of Battery A. I came to enjoy that a lot.
Well, and I don't want to gloss over what you just said either. So it sounds like you're saying that you came up with an innovation for how those anti-aircraft units were going to do their job. What was the idea you figured out, and ultimately, what was the implication of that?
Well, if one was to simplify the thing, the manual had said you dig a hole in the ground and put the gun, and you had three places that you had to lower it, but we found that you could do it all at one time rather than this leg and then this leg and this leg, and that's what the manual said. And we did it all at one time and just dropped them. From that point on, Colonel Campbell had a little, I thought, an interest in what I was doing, because he would come by periodically. And he was about 60 years old, had been at West Point. Anyway, it was the start of a relationship. And after we were overseas, we were notified that we would come under a different group of anti-aircraft people, and the head was Colonel Campbell.
Well, and I don't want to oversimplify or get it wrong, but it sounds like you're saying just by seeing a better way to do something, you probably save these gun crews time. And in war, I mean, in business, they say time is money, but in war, time could be life or death, right?
Well, that's one way to word it. It's just simplified in the time we could get in position to fire. But, you know, the guns of that day is so different than what they have today. They didn't have any of the computerized thing, and so it was kind of get it into shape and make sure it's level, because what controls and guidance we had premised on being absolutely flat.
Well, and not to fast forward too far, but it just makes me wonder in my mind, because I know about some of the things you've done in farming, and, you know, the sustained success you've had in passing it on to your kids and grandkids now. Is that something, that idea of, hey, there might be a better way to do this, is that a pattern that's followed you through the rest of these 101 years?
Well, I guess I'd have to say I'm kind of bent that way. I've never dwelled on that aspect of it, but certainly in the military, we tried to do that.
Time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 101-year-old Jack Wolf of Fresno, California. As a farmer, a businessman, and philanthropist, he's built quite a legacy. His family stewards thousands and thousands of acres today, but before he owned even a small parcel of land, he had to make it through an infamously dangerous stretch of sand called Omaha Beach in June 1944. We'll hear about that when we come back. And if you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the orders he received before the Normandy invasion. He still has them nearly 75 years later. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 101-year-old Jack Wolf. Originally from Arizona, he has long made his home in California's San Joaquin Valley, where his efforts in the areas of agriculture, water issues, and philanthropy were recognized with an honorary doctorate from Fresno State. But that never would have happened. His businesses never would have been founded. He never would have met his wife of nearly 70 years, Bernice. And dozens of descendants never would have been born if he didn't make it through some of World War II's most ferocious battles. We'll hear about the Normandy invasion and the Battle of the Bulge and how Jack experienced those as the commander of Battery A in the 204th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion.
We had a supply sergeant that I don't know whatever happened to him. I wouldn't be a bit surprised he got put in jail if he carried out what he was doing for us. Our unit had no tents. We lamented that we had lived long enough in pup tents. He came to me and said if he could use the trucks for a few hours, he thought maybe he could find some tents. And a forward airfield, and the pilots all had tents lined up, and he went through and struck the tents, threw them on the truck, and hauled them away and left the cots, the pilots' cots out in the open. He was that sort of a guy. He could find stuff. He found 4 truckloads of dynamite one time, and that sounds crazy for anti-aircraft. But if you're digging holes or a base to get into for your gun, it sure helps to blast it with some dynamite.
Well, and when you told that story of him pulling the switcheroo with the pilot's tents from the airfield, I'm just wondering, you know, if they figured out who did it and came and buzzed your position.
No, they didn't. At least they didn't come, as far as I know.
Well, you said you headed overseas in January of 1944. Had you ever in your life been on a ship before?
My first time, but there were 18,000 on that ship. We were in a convoy, of course. It took about 10 days to get to Liverpool. That's where we disembarked and stayed at a small community out of Liverpool called Leeds. And we stayed at Leeds until our guns and so forth all came. Then went to Weymouth on the southern part of England and set up, and we were disappointed that a battery was about 3 miles inland from the port and the others, but that was part of their game plan. We were the first to move overseas of our battalion, and the others followed. We stayed there, well, from about 1st of February till the invasion date.
Well, I want to hear what you were doing in that time period, but I wonder, too, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I didn't live through this. I may be completely off, but I'm guessing that if you're on this ship going across the Atlantic, and you can't get off the ship, you can't go anywhere, you probably have a lot of time to think. Did you think that you were ever going to come back to America? Did you have that concern that you may lose your life over there?
Well, frankly, I did not. I guess some may dwell on that, but I think the average GI thought that he was invincible. I don't know about an infantry guy, the first ones out, but in my case, I never thought that I wouldn't make it.
And so from February till June, you're in England. You continuing to train? Are you seeing examples of what war is like right there in England?
Well, we were in place, and we fired at German planes a time or two. At that period of time, there were more German planes than later. Once in a while, we'd hit a plane, and that day, by the standards of today, the plane had to almost search out our fire and fly into it to get knocked down. But we had that. And if one plane went down, everyone claimed credit. So about 20 different batteries would claim credit.
Well, and one of the things that was happening at that point, you talk about German planes, they had a lot of German fighters that would fly at night and try to shoot down American planes coming back from their bombing missions. Is that who you were firing at, those invaders?
Well, some of it was at night, some of it was during the day. I don't want to overemphasize that. We probably had a dozen times over the 3 months we were there.
Well, and this may seem like a basic, obvious question. I know you're going to be experiencing this a lot more once you went across the channel. But as far as how those gun crews operate, how many people does it take to run one of those emplacements? And what was your specific role in how that battery operated?
My specific role was to find there were 8 cannons in a battery, and each gun section had 2 turret 50 caliber And so you had the three units times eight. Battery commander had to locate those. And if there was something to be, as they said, protected, then you were supposed to locate them so it would be kind of, well, protect the site. But you didn't want to fire on your own people. So as a battery commander, you had to find the location. When you moved to a new site, you took with you your first sergeant and your communications sergeant. And we'd move into an area. I would pick the sites, and then my first lieutenant, executive officer, would bring up the guns, and the first sergeant would kind of know which direction to point them. Our communication guy would be laying the telephone wires to our battery office.
As the commander of your battery, are you the one that has to give an order to fire?
No. If they saw an airplane, you just fired. Now, let's jump forward. Okay. Now we're out, we're on Normandy. We've just gotten there, and that was under our tight control. You'd either have a period where you were supposed to not fire at anything because we had so many aircraft, or U.S. or Allied aircraft coming from England. There were just dozens of them. And then there would be a period when they'd all go back to refuel, and anything in the air, you were told to fire on it. And so we had that back and forth.
And, you know, so much has been said about D-Day and the whole Normandy invasion, and people know about the loss of life. They know how important that day, the longest day, was to that whole operation. But what about the lead-up to that? How far in advance did you know that you guys would be crossing the channel?
Well, whatever date here.
You have your orders. They say top secret headquarters, southern base section. And it's got your outfit on it, Battery A, 204th AAA. It says the priority list and the embarco plan indicates that your unit is now in its concentration camp, Weymouth, after complying with POM SSV, vehicle waterproofing, acquisition of required equipment and supplies, and other preparatory functions. You will be prepared to move on or after 2 June 1944 on 6 hours' notice. You will receive further instructions on exercise hornpipe through command channels. And again, it's noted top secret. So when you see these orders, what goes through your mind?
Well, we have been training to do just that, and the time had come. It's been a long time ago. You asked, what did I think that day? I don't really recall what I thought that day, except we knew that we would be going over the channel. On the day after we got that, we got the six-hour notice, and we moved then to Southampton and boarded the LST.
And how many men in your battery?
165 men. Myself as battery commander, had an exec officer, and then had two platoons. And each platoon had a first lieutenant and a second lieutenant.
So here, I mean, this is more than 3 years after you entered the Army. You've had all this training. You've had exercises in the States and there in England. You know what you're supposed to do, what you're going to be doing. You've already been firing on German planes there in England. But did any of that prepare you for what you saw when you got to Omaha Beach?
Well, I don't think so. It was amazing, Omaha Beach, the magnitude and all the action that was taking place and the ships. And as we came in, we were supposed to, once we got loaded on the LST, our LST moved, anchored near the Isle of Wight. We didn't see anything until a couple of days later, we all of a sudden became aware that there were just planes everywhere circling in the air and pulling gliders and off to the sea. There were just hundreds and hundreds of landing craft moving, had destroyers around, but they were moving, and you knew then the day had come, and it was just a matter of time. We moved out of the anchorage, and that's when we received a packet of orders, and it mostly was maps of where we were supposed to go, maps that maybe were out 4 by 4 feet, and some of them had such detail that you could tell exactly where you were supposed to end up and put a gun. Our order said that 8 hours after the first landing, we were supposed to land on D-Day. It turned out that they had problems, as we all know, at Omaha Beach, and they pulled our unit off to the side behind some battleships, and we stayed there exactly 24 hours. It was a long 24-hour, because we were at the point where swells kept that boat moving all the time. And the battleships were firing. So anyway, there was a lot going on. They wanted more infantry rather than us, and there really wasn't as many German aircraft by that time. Anyway, we stayed there, and most of the guys thought that if they just could get off that tub, they'd be happy. But we then lined up and got ashore. It took about 2 hours for us to get to our location where we were supposed to deploy. Far enough north, it didn't get dark until about 11 o'clock. At that time of the year. So we were in place in time to just collapse and go to sleep.
Well, with all that daylight, though, I'm sure you saw some things that most of us have never seen and will never see, and maybe you never wanted to see. Can you describe for us that place on that day? I mean, this is June 7th, 1944. What did you see when you came ashore, and what did you experience for the rest of that day?
Well, there's just unbelievable activity taking place. If there's one thing that I do recall that's different, is the 2.5-ton trucks loaded with bodies of GIs that had died, and rigor mortis had set them up in whatever shape they were. It caught your attention. And then views that whenever I think about, this is just something that sticks in my mind just like it was yesterday. And that could have been us. Here's how we look going over.
Yeah, so you've got a picture of an LST loaded with trucks and supplies, and then here's Omaha Beach.
Two levels. So anyway, and then here's the beach area. And there was just activity like you can't believe.
And you said it took about 2 hours for you guys to get into your position. So where was that, and did you have anything to fire on in those next couple days?
We were up there near St. Laurent, which is only about 2 miles from the beach, inland, and that's where we were supposed to set up. So we got there and found our places, got our guns set up. I told you earlier that there were times when you were not to fire on anything. And we'd been there about a week when a German plane came over, and by good luck, we knocked the tail off that airplane, and it came down, and it was a Focke-Wulf. Now, anti-aircraft folks did a lot of training on identifying planes, so we knew, at least we thought, we knew what this was. At any rate, we knocked it down.
And when you say identifying planes, you're talking about by their silhouette in the sky, even when they're far off?
Yes, the silhouette, and of course, as it starts making us strafing run at you. You know, you have an idea that they don't like you.
Well, how frequently did that happen over the, probably, I guess, almost a year from that point?
Well, we had several strafing that came through, but the Germans' Air Force had been reduced a lot by that time, and so there'd be a single plane comes flying fast as it could, and then strafe or dropping some bombs. I recall one time they came over, a German bomber, and dropped the bombs, and we all stood up and looked at it. We all got knocked down on our backside because of the pressure, the concussion.
Well, I'm sure there are some other close calls you can tell me about, but it strikes me, because your memory is so clear, and people, when they hear me say again, you're 101, they're saying, no way, that's impossible. But you were there, you experienced these things. And I'm sure in all the years since, you've read a lot, you've seen a lot, you've heard a lot said about the Normandy invasion. Is there anything maybe that you think is a misperception? Or is there something that most of us don't understand about what it was like to be there that you'd like to share?
Well, I'm going to repeat myself in a way. There was so much action taking place. I don't think the average person can comprehend. There were just ships everywhere. There were airplanes everywhere, mostly us, or preponderance was our ally. It was an event of such magnitude, it's hard to describe. We were there and saw it, but it's hard to tell another person the magnitude of it.
Jack Wolfe, 101 years old, is our guest today. If you head to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a brief video of Jack with those top secret invasion orders he's held on to for 75 years. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the privilege of visiting with a centenarian who has seen more than his fair share of history, Jack Wolfe, 101 years old. He commanded Battery A of the 204th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion in Europe during World War II. He described for us what he witnessed at Normandy's Omaha Beach, coming ashore the day after the initial Allied landings. There's one question I haven't asked you, Jack, and some may find it a little trite, but I've found that the veterans I've encountered have a pretty broad spectrum of perspectives on it. So, were you scared? Were you frightened? Did those situations and those scenes you told us about produce fear inside of you?
No, I was not. I think we were apprehensive. What was the future? What was coming? Because we'd never done this before. I don't remember being afraid, but then you got to remember that we followed the infantry. They had had cleared up. It was just about as safe as being right here today.
Well, that might be a little exaggeration. I think your office is a little more secure than a gun emplacement where the enemy can strafe you or bomb you.
Well, perhaps. Perhaps.
So, everyone has heard about D-Day, and they've seen those pictures. But I'm guessing there were probably a few places or moments for you in the rest of the war that people have never heard about. Are there some things that stand out to you for whatever reason that are really memorable?
Well, of course, we were all in new country for us to see. I got to tell you that I look back and think those were it's strange to say, pretty good times for us as a military force. We were overwhelming the better. We were not infantry. We had, well, a Battle of the Bulge came along. Our unit was assigned a bridge at Mezières, France. If you look at Bastogne, which was a major highway cross area, if the Germans could get Bastogne, Mezières was the next move. But Bastogne denied them that, and so they went towards Dinant or Liège. So I've often thought that we lucked in. If Bastogne had fallen, maybe we wouldn't be here. Who knows? But we were at Mezières. I told you we had all this dynamite that Sergeant Otto had rescued. So at the bridge, we were the only unit there, my battery. We wired that thing with that dynamite to blow it in case we needed to, and put our turret, 50 calibers, where we thought would do the best defense, and the 40 millimeters. On the second day after we got that all done, a general officer came along and wanted to ask me what we were doing, and I showed him that we had wired the bridge, had the dynamite and the two wires there, and a 24-hour look so it wouldn't get touched inadvertently. He commended us for my unit for what we'd done, and I didn't know, but he later gave us a Bronze Star for that. After a few days, as you well know, not a few days, after quite few weeks, the 101st Airborne came through, and they set up just outside of Mezières. They crossed the bridge and then set up about 2 miles out of town, a staging area, so they could then do their assignment. And I remember vividly that day at Christmas or the day after Christmas, where the fogs had moved and the skies were just filled with transport planes. It's just hard to imagine the number of aircraft that was there, each one leaving a vapor stream because of the temperature. Anyway, there are memories that you have.
Right. Some people know the story and some people don't, but you're referring to the weather finally clearing so they can go and help the guys who are cut off in Bastogne.
Yes, that's right. There were just all sorts of transport planes. We were not close enough. We were 36 miles from Bastogne.
And I've got a follow-up, too. When you talk about rigging the dynamite up to the bridge, am I inferring correctly that that would have been your decision to make, whether or not to blow the bridge?
That's right, and we would, well, and I told the general officer that we wouldn't blow it until we had to, if we saw the German artillery coming or tank force or whatever it might be.
That's a pretty daunting decision to consider, isn't it?
Well, I guess as I look back now and you ask the question, but that day we thought we were just saving our own skin.
Because if a German tank unit did come your way, I mean, you guys can fire everything you have, but it's unlikely you would have been able to hold that position, right?
No, we wouldn't be able to. Actually, we had a 40 millimeter is only about so big. Well, they had issued us armor shells that would supposedly stop. It's a far cry from what field artillery could do.
Well, and except for mentioning the vapor trails of the airplane, you didn't discuss the weather with me. But I've interviewed enough guys who are in that part of the world then to know that you must have been a little colder than you were growing up in Arizona or here in the valley all the years since.
It was cold. It was bitter cold. At Mezières, as a battery headquarters, we had liberated a two-story home right there near the bridge, a wonderful house. As cold as it was, our battery, when it got to nightfall, we could have a cognac and have a nice fire going, and we thought war was hell. We just saw a different side of it.
Yeah, that's a little different than trying to dig a foxhole and you can't because the ground's frozen and losing your toes or your fingers. Are you saying you could fit all 165 guys in that house?
No, the gun sections had to stay out by their guns. And but by that time, we had tents for them, and they had wood heaters inside. to warm up.
Well, and you mentioned the weather clearing, and you referred to Christmas. You're going up on your 102nd birthday in September, so you've had a lot of Christmases. But what was unique about Christmas 1944, and how often do you reflect back on that?
Well, I don't think I reflect on Christmas Day there other than the sight of seeing all those planes. Obviously, Christmas in that arena was a lot different than subsequent Christmases.
Yeah, I guess you can't take that for granted. Another one kind of out of the blue here. You know, you had mentioned that your brother went overseas after you did. All that time that you're in Europe and you're in these combat situations and you're having to make difficult decisions, how often did you think about your brother and what he might be facing?
Well, we got there on D-Day. He got there about Christmas. I mean, that period. About the time the Bulls came in from the South. But he received an award. He was a patents group. He was also an officer, and he led a small boat across the Rhine. Patton made a crossing.
Once you knew he was over there, were you thinking that you two might be able to meet up somewhere?
Yes, we did, and we, now this is after the surrender. I learned that his unit was near Munich, and so I got my Jeep and we drove over. I found him and we visited for a couple hours. I know I told him that the 204th had led the parade and it was safe when he got there to make it safe for him. He didn't quite agree. But anyway, it was that. And because I was notified by Colonel Campbell and Colonel Watson that they recommended me to be a battalion commander and get to go to Japan. So I was detached from my battery and told to go toward Le Havre. And en route, I stopped at a military base to get some to eat. The guy said they had a bomb dropped in Japan, and of course it was the first atom bomb. 2 or 3 days later, we had the second, and you know how that evolved. And so I was detached from my unit. I learned that my brother's regiment was put in at the debarkation thing going back to England, and they had them all named after cigarettes, Campbell and Lucky Strike. And I found him there, and he got me aboard a flat-bottom boat. It got over with about another 1,000 people. Back to England, I went to a military base to await orders to go back home. Let me digress. When we landed in Normandy, we were under 1st Army. And then during the Battle of the Bulge, we were placed under 3rd Army. And then from 3rd Army, we went with the 9th Air Force Tactical Command. And they were flying their guys home. And I was hoping that I'd get a flight home. But because the Air Force was flying their guys, some congressmen objected. So they changed that. And so I got to go home on a Liberty ship. Went through a big storm. I thought maybe I was going to end up and lose it there. But about the 8th day, we went into Boston Harbor. We got on a train, went to Kilmer, had to turn in things that you had, like my .45 caliber pistol that officers all carried. Finally got on a DC-3, and they flew me to Marchfield, and then from Marchfield into San Pedro.
Was there a memorable reunion with your family after all that time overseas?
Yes, from San Pedro, I went into downtown Los Angeles. I first went out to where we lived, but none of my former roommates were around. They were all in the service. So I took the train out, the night train, went to Phoenix, and the next morning poked a doorbell. My mother answered the door.
Just judging off the expression on your face right now, I'm guessing you can still picture the expression on her face.
Yes, she was pleased to see me. And my brother, twin brother, then came along about 10 days later.
Well, I know we've been going a while here and we talked about a lot of things, but I just want to make sure we didn't leave anything out. Is there anything else about your time in Europe during the war that stands out, that you think is significant, or maybe even just reminds you of how fortunate you are to be alive?
Our unit was sent to what they call Market Garden campaign, convoyed down there. And as you know, that didn't turn out very successful. They had moved forward until they ran out of supplies, gasoline mostly. There was a lull for about, 40 days, and we were at Namur, Belgium. We located the guns, of course, around the bridge. The officers liberated a place to stay, and it was next door to a mortuary. And we each had our own private casket to sleep in.
And you're not kidding. You slept in a casket.
We slept in a casket. It was. You asked whether I could recall things. That's one I recall. Yeah.
And Market Garden, of course, folks know about some of the paratroopers that jumped there, and this is where the bridge too far came from, and people have heard some of those stories. What was the hardest part of that period for you? What was the most challenging aspect?
Well, I think most of it was getting there, and they had a big bridge we were supposed to protect, and trying to get forward, but there was resistance. The program that they thought they would be able to do didn't come to pass. So we had about 10 days. As a battery, I don't think we were concerned about our health or welfare more than any place else, but it was kind of uncomfortable.
Well, it occurs to me, too, and I know it's probably a difficult thing to think about, but this is the reality of war. If you are the commander of a battery with 165 guys, you're going to deal with casualties. There are going to be replacements that you have to bring into that battery. How difficult was that aspect of it for you?
It so happened we were fortunate enough we only lost one guy. As a commander, I wrote a letter to his parent. His name was Horton. I really think Horton had picked up some other ailment. He wasn't shot. He just got sick one day, got him to the hospital, and he died about 3 days later. Other than that, we all survived. In my life, I've experienced two or three things. One is the Great Depression, and it was very severe as a young, very young person went through that. And then World War II with the 5 years military service, and then following with Wolf Farming Company.
Well, and I know I've been asking you questions about your 5 years in the service, but there's all these years since. And Wolf Farming is a pioneering organization. You've done things other people haven't done. You've had incredible success. And people listening, if they don't know your name, they certainly probably have eaten some almonds or pistachios or some tomato products that you had something to do with. I mean, that's fair to say, isn't it?
Well, I hope they eat them. And I eat more of them.
And I'm sure we could be here for a few days talking about what you've done in the farming industry. But when you look back on it all, what are the things that you're most proud of?
Oh, I think for the good times we've had, good luck we've had. Luck beats brains any day.
What's the best piece of advice you think you have to share after all these years?
Well, as corny as it sounds, I think to have a goal. Think out what you want and how you get there. But to have a goal, don't just coast. Have a direction that you want to take and get there.
Well, I was going to ask you what your secret is to staying so sharp and active and in good shape at 101, and is that part of it? Do you still have goals that you're chasing after?
Well, at 101, my goal is to live till tomorrow.
And we look forward to seeing that goal achieved again and again for Jack Wolf, 101 for now, heading for 102 this fall. We're out of time on today's program, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.